I've given you a list of poems that I consider to be your favorites. And I'd like to know, with regard to each one, what you remember about the circumstances of composition, the dates, or any other factual data that might be important.
I don't remember the date of Borderline, but I think it was perhaps written maybe 20 years ago, and I recall quite clearly it sort of coming to me, just sort of coming to me out of nowhere one night, and I put it down, and it has remained more or less as it was put down then, a little eight-line lyric. The poem Cross, which seems to be one of my best-known poems, and one which I have very often used in lectures to wake an audience up if they looked as if they were going to sleep, was written just when, I don't recall, but a very long time ago, I think perhaps about 1928 or 29, I think perhaps while I was still at Lincoln University, and it is a part of a number of things that I have done on the problems of miscegenation, the poem Cross, the poem Mulatto, the play Mulatto, the short story Father and Son are all really related, and the germ idea, I think, for this poem came from an anecdote which my foster aunt, Tori Harper, with whom I live now here in this house, told one time about a white saloon keeper who had a Negro mistress, and I've forgotten now in what town, but she could tell us because it's a true story. And he had apparently several children by this colored woman, and she would send one or the other of these children to his saloon on occasion to get the weekly money for the grocery bill and so on. And the man had a very profane way of kidding with the little boys, his illegitimate sons, and using bad language, and being small children, they perhaps didn't know the difference between bad and good language. And so one night, one of the little boys came to get some money, and the man said, "Oh, get away, you little so-and-so," or something. And the little colored boy, in front of many white customers in the place, said, "Stop fooling around, you old so-and-so, you old son of a bitch," to the white man, his father. Whereupon the father knocked him unconscious. And that was the anecdote that gave me the initial interest, I think, in doing this poem, Cross. My old man's a white old man and my old mother's black. The Dance African, I don't remember when that was written. I simply remember that it had to be written after I had made a sea voyage to Africa as a sailor. Dream Variations, I think, is of the same period, and that period would certainly be in the 20s. Harlem and Other Poems and Dream Deferred were written about a year before the publication of the book Montage of a Dream Deferred. And most of them were written as a sequence, including Harlem, especially to go into a unified volume-like montage. They were written especially for a montage. Judgment Day is one of the oldest of my poems, probably written about maybe about 1920, maybe shortly after I came out of high school or around that time. It's one of a number of poems that I have done related to the religious expression of the Negro people, the folk expression of the Negro people in regard to religion. Mulatto, I have indicated that it's a part of the series of things that I've done to which the poem Cross belongs. Mother to Son, quite an old poem of mine written perhaps either while I was still in high school or shortly after I graduated from Central High in Cleveland. It might have been written in Mexico around 1920-21. The Madame to You series were written about mid-1940s, I think, and I think some of them appeared in magazines before they were in book form, and once I had two or three of them, I thought, well, it just as well be a book section or a series, and so I consciously added some more to the initial first two or three poems about Madame Alberta K. Johnson. The Negro Speaks of Rivers, the description of the writing of that one, to which I could not add any more, is included in my autobiography, The Big Sea. The Negro Mother, don't remember when it was written, but I remember using it on my very early lecture tours in the early 1930s, and I believe that I write about it in The Big Sea, too, or in I Wonder as I Wander, about reading it at Mrs. Bethune's college in Daytona, and how much she liked that particular poem. Roland Hayes Beaton was written just after the incident in which he was beaten in Georgia, and the date I don't recall, but I think it's indicated in my autobiography as well. Southern Mammy Sings, don't remember anything about when I wrote that one at all, nor the time. Song for Dark Girl is an early poem of mine, written perhaps in the 20s, I think. The South, a very early poem of mine, written when I was perhaps 20 years old myself, and before I had experienced very much of the South. I don't even know if I'd been into the South at that time, but of course the news of lynchings and Southern brutalities were very much in the papers then, just as they are now, in this age of civil rights. The Weary Blues was written in New York and Washington, and during the time when I was at when I was working in Washington, having just gotten through with a year in Paris and had come back to Harlem and heard the music of the blues, wrote this poem, which was entered in the opportunity contest, and there is more elaboration on this also in my book, The Big Sea, I think. Song for Banjo Dance. I think that I wrote this poem especially to send to the Crisis because they had expressed interest in seeing some more of my work, and this is one of the few poems that I seem to recall writing more or less deliberately. It's not an inspirational poem. To Little Lover Last Dead, the early 1920s, Jazzonia, the early 1920s, Harlem Sweeties, a bit later. Harlem Sweeties, I think, is a poem of the 30s. Minstrel Man, very early poem of mine, early 1920s. Death of an Old Seaman, the same. Dear Lovely Death, the same. It was read at Alelia Walker's funeral, but I had written it not especially for that funeral. It had been written sometime before. Blues, Fantasy, Negro Dancers are all early poems of mine. I don't remember the circumstances of writing them. Winter Moon was written at Carmel, California, where I lived for, something like 2 years, and wrote a number of little lyric poems there. Sea Calm, probably written in the mid-1920s, after I'd made some voyages to sea as a seaman. A genius child? I don't remember anything about the writing of that now. I seem to recall that it was published in the New York Herald Tribune. A drum? Don't remember. A House in Taos, the writing of it is described in my book, The Big Sea, to which I could not add anything more. A Trumpet Player was written during the time when 52nd Street in New York was quite a little jazz street, the block between 5th Avenue and 6th Avenue, I believe. And I used to go there occasionally to hear, particularly to hear Billie Holiday sing. Kids Sleepy? Don't remember. Uncle Tom? I think Uncle Tom was a newspaper poem. I was doing a series of poems one time for the Associated Negro Press, a poem a week, and not getting paid, but I'd been asked if I could send them a poem every week. And so it's a kind of practice verse. It's not really a poem, it's a verse. Easy Boogie is a part of a montage. It was deliberately written to go in a sequence of poems and montage of A Dream Deferred. Advice? Don't recall when or how that one was written. Jam Session is a part of montage. A Dream Boogie, Variation, also part of montage, written under the same conditions as the others I've just spoken about. Brass Platoons, done one of my very early poems, very early 1920s, growing out of childhood memory of my own, which I, while yet living in Kansas, I believe I was in the eighth grade, and I worked for a time in one of the hotels in Lawrence, Kansas, and had to myself clean the old brass platoons that they used in those days. The Breath of a Rose was written, I think, deliberately as a lyric for William Grant Still, who wanted some lyrics to set to music, and if I'm not mistaken, I wrote this poem quite consciously to be set to music as a song. The question, do I often revise poems after publication? No, not often, but sometimes I do, but not very often. Question, in what areas do you consider published criticism of your work best and weakest? I would like to ask for a clarification on that. I don't know what you mean.
I had in mind your possible opinion that you thought that criticism hadn't discovered some important elements of your work, or that it had been, especially good in picking up other elements of your work that you thought important.
Other than the book by Jean Wagner, growing out of his PhD thesis. A book published in France and called, what is it called? It's up there, you know what it's called. Negro Poets of America, or something of the sort. Other than his long study of my work there, I feel there's been very little criticism in depth of any of my work. Really, I've been very fortunate in having received, on the whole, favorable book reviews for almost all of my books. I would say the book reviews have been 90% favorable, and with all of that good luck, they have not made me a bestseller, but nevertheless they have been good, kind, usually sympathetic book reviews, but critically they have had very little analysis, very little doubt. They simply say The Negro Speaks of Rivers is a beautiful poem or something simple like that, that I could easily say myself.
Did you speculate on why criticism hasn't dug deeply into your work?
Because I have not been a fashionable poet, in the sense that the poets of the, shall we say, the Carl Shapiro, Alan Tate school have been, or the school that perhaps grew out of Pound and Eliot, and the also be. Because I'm not a white poet. The major criticism in our country, the magazines that analyze and tear apart literary work of magazines like the Kenyon Review and the Partisan Review and so on, have devoted really very little space to writers of color. And so we have not had the kind of, shall we say, intensive criticism, the kind of probing commentary that many white poets that nobody remembers, really, many white poets who perhaps were good poets, but certainly not anywhere near as well known as myself or Condi Cullen or Claude McKay, have had many articles written about them and very much commented upon. So I think it's partially the kind of block in the minds of American critics who seemingly, perhaps unconsciously, feel that writing by and about Negroes is outside of the American mainstream and outside of their scope. Maybe they don't know anything about much about American Negroes. Maybe that's why they don't attempt to criticize very, very deeply a work written about the Negro or the Negro problem in America. I don't know. That's a conjecture. In any case, there has been very little real comment in depth on my work. At what times in your career was the existence of racial violence a meaningful stimulus in your writing? Oh, I think at all times, because since I can remember my earliest childhood, when read about lynchings in the South, when read about race riots, when read about mobs of brutalizing Negroes, when read about the Ku Klux Klan, and that has gone right on up to the Harlem riots of 1964. So that element has always, in a way, given me something to feel emotional about and therefore to write about. What would you say is the hardest part of writing poetry? There isn't any hard part for me. I write poetry because I like it. I put it down on paper often because it sort of comes to me in one form or another, particularly the blues and my poems in the folk idiom seem to come out of subconscious memories, I suppose, or subconscious memories of phrases that I've heard or something of that sort. And I write by ear, really. I'm not a very formal poet, and I very seldom deliberately sit down to write a poem unless somebody wants a song lyric next week or a core wants a poem for a greeting card. That's the poem that I just wrote a few weeks ago, especially for core on request, but that doesn't happen very often. I would say perhaps I've not written more than a dozen such poems in my life, but one of them, one of my best known poems was written on request. That's the poem A Freedom Train, which the editor John Davis of Our World especially asked me to write at the time that the American Heritage Foundation was about to send a freedom train throughout the country under segregated conditions. Do you speak personally in much of your poetry, or do you usually use a person or persona or mask to express your thoughts indirectly? Well, of course, when I write a poem like The Negro Mother, I'm not speaking personally. Or when I write a poem like I Am Black, Black as the Night is Black, I'm not speaking personally because my complexion is not that dark, but I am writing by and large personally, in that I am writing as a member of the black race, of the black peoples of the world. And when I write a poem like The Negro Mother, even though it's a female gender, I am writing as one who has also known difficulties and oppression and poverty. And not always is the I that much related to my own feelings, but in Madame to You, for example, no. In Madame to You, I'm creating a fictional character, much as I do in Simple, kind of female Simple, and the I in those poems would hardly be myself, except insofar as some of the problems expressed in the Madam to You poems are problems that anybody, male or female, and colored or white, for that matter, could have. The problem of the unpaid phone bill, for example. If you wanted to stretch a point, you could say that that was myself at times. Do you think the critics are fully appreciated? Ask your mama. Well, appreciated is hardly a word I would use. They haven't by any means explored its meaning. If you mean that from that standpoint, they haven't paid as much attention, then appreciated is right. But if you mean praised it, then no, the poem has been praised. It got quite good reviews when it appeared. It has not been examined with any great perspicacity, shall we say. Mainly literary events in your life since 1940. Main literary events in your life since 1940. That's
maybe
a very broad one. I don't know.
That was exploring.
So I have covered the initial list handed to me and will now be subject to verbal interrogation. Who said hi? You look so fancy. Hi, yourself, Hans. Where does that come from? That's right. Hi, yourself, Hans Varla. It comes from Midsummer's Night's Dream, the thing that Candle Lee was in, where he played, you know, that groveling servant.
I think that's it.
Somebody said, hi, yourself, Hans Varla.
I have a few more questions
sure.
I'd like to ask you here. Would you say that all or most of your best poems are on that list? Are there any that you are particularly favorably disposed to that are not on the list?
Oh, gee, I don't know. Merry-Go-Round is not on there. Where's the Jim Crow section on this merry-go-round?
Yeah,
it's one of my favorite poems. It's one of the best to use for audiences in lecturing and speaking.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no great partiality toward any particular poems. It just happens that since I know that the public has liked some poems a very great deal, I of course like them too.
Mm-hmm. What literary achievements of yours have given you the most personal satisfaction? That again.
All of it. I've enjoyed my whole career.
Let me see. What people?
Oh, I might add to that one that I get more a sense of achievement out of writing prose. I have said this before, and perhaps in my autobiography, since I've indicated that poetry comes fairly easily to me, but in writing a short story or a longer work, a novel, it is really a considerable amount of actual work. And to discipline oneself to do that work and to get it done when I have finished a prose piece, particularly if it is something that's taken several weeks or several months, I have a greater sense of achievement than I do in the writing of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
That, I might say, is a sense of achievement with me to successfully create a work in prose, particularly an extended work.
Do you have any short pieces of prose, like essay, that you particularly like?
Like essays? No, I haven't done too many essays, as I guess you know. No, I haven't.
Mm-hmm. What people and organizations would you say gave you the most help or inspiration, help of any kind, during your career? Any individuals?
Oh, a great many people have helped me a great deal. It's hardly fair to name some and not name others,
and some
do not care to be named, you know, because either they wish to remain anonymous or they would be embarrassed or they would be bothered by other people seeking help, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I hadn't thought of
but,
that.
Of course, one can name the late Carl Van Vechten is one who helped not only myself, but many, many people in the arts, both Negro and white, and particularly helpful to some of the Negro artists, such as, well, for example, Paul Robeson in helping to launch his career. Certainly myself, the sculptor Richmond Barthé. But I think I go into this in the Big C and name several people among the Negro group that he's been helpful to, and of course many white artists as well. And I have had the good fortune to have had in my life several people with the generous heart toward art and artists and Negroes who have helped me without demanding anything in return, really.
How would you say that the literary situation for Negro writers has changed most since you started writing?
Well, of course, the areas of publication have broadened. Since I started writing, the areas not only of publication but of making a living from writing have broadened greatly within perhaps the last 10 years. When I began to write, a Negro was never known to have sold anything to Hollywood. They don't sell to Hollywood very voluminously, shall we say, now, but at least they do occasionally sell something to Hollywood. Occasionally, something by a Negro writer, like Raisin in the Sun, is filmed, is made into a major film. Television, radio were practically closed to Negro writers for many years. That is no longer wholly true. The period of the 20s was a period when almost every publisher wanted to have a Negro writer on his list. Then there came a long slump and a long lull in which there was very little interest in Negro creative work, but it has now returned, gone full cycle again during the late 1950s and early 60s, perhaps due to the freedom movement and the interest in news relative to Negroes and their problems. Artistically, there has been a kind of boom, and at the moment, almost every major publisher in America has at least one Negro writer on his list. Almost every major magazine publishes at least one or two or more articles or pieces or stories by a Negro a year. I think the cycle is about to come to its end, and probably be another 20 years before we were very much in vogue again, because it's like any other kind of vogue, a vogue for the French theater or a vogue for Japanese movies, you know? And although we're much more than a vogue, we're a problem too, but nevertheless, that doesn't mean that publishers can continually make money out of Negro books, and when the slump comes, they won't be so anxious to accept them so readily as is happening now, which I'm delighted about.
Well, I hope it takes longer than 20 years before you go out of vogue.
What was that? He's the one borrowing money, I know. Every time I see him on the street, he wants a quarter. Come to ask Mr. Harper or Mrs. Harper. They would really have rung it.
Or tell him that Mr. Emanuel's very rich because he's got fellowships and things.
Oh, yeah, tell him Emanuel.
That'll be your biggest star.
A home out in Westchester, wherever it is.
How would you say that Africa, its presence or its history, has influenced your creative work, as distinguished from your nonfiction?
You mean its overall presence or its contemporary presence?
Contemporary.
I don't think a great deal. I mean, I've always been drawn to Africa, and particularly after I made trips there as a seaman, and in recent years I've been there, I believe, four times, I guess. But it has not greatly influenced my writing or gone into it, I don't believe. Not consciously, at any rate.
Mm-hmm. Could you make a comparison of your, maybe you can't do this, comparison of your concern over the purely artistic qualities of your works as contrasted to the way that they contribute to the nation's understanding of Negroes?
I'm sorry, that's a little complex for me. Could you give me that one again? Yeah.
Compare the degree of your concern for the purely aesthetic qualities of your work with your concern for the extent to which they illuminate Negroes.
I am more concerned with the extent to which they illuminate Negro life, help to explain it to people, help to make them think about our problems. And this may not sound like a very craftsman-like thing to say, but I really am not greatly concerned about a conscious craftsmanship. I unfortunately write poetry as it comes to me, as I've said, more or less, revising not a great deal. Prose I work over. Prose I may do 3-4 drafts or more of a story or an article or a novel. The simple books had at least 3 or 4 drafts, each one of them. Extensive revision, extensive working over. So I do work hard on those books, but I don't have any conscious theories of craftsmanship. And I work hard on the books because I want them to say better what I'm trying to say. And I'm more concerned with what I am trying to say in the way of democratic statement than I am with the overall format of the work itself.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of simple, would you say that the best of simple is actually in the book of that title, the best of simple?
Yes. Well, all of simple is in that book, except the few chapters that seemed a bit dated or just weren't very good, but a very, very little is left out. The best of simple really contains all 3 of the other books.
Do you consider that the best of your humor in prose then is in that book, the best of simple?
Yes, I think so. Mm-hmm. The most, because I'm not always too humorous in the other things. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think the best humor is in there.
You think your reputation as a humorist misses any point?
Now that I don't understand the.
That is, do you think that you are given credit for being more of a humorist in purpose than you are?
No, I don't quite know what you're driving at, but the books have been very well received, and I have been compared by a few critics with the great American humorist, with Mark Twain and Dooley and Will Rogers. And so I can't complain about the reception of my humor, if that's
perhaps
what you're
perhaps
saying.
Perhaps what I had in mind was this. I wonder if you feel that sometimes critics have called humor what you really meant to be irony or something that's not quite...
Well, I myself, no, I don't think so. At least I haven't felt any errors there. Humor incorporates irony and satire, to my mind at least it does. And so I think the critics have certainly been fair there. And there's a very good piece by Arthur P. Davis, as you know, in Phylon on the simple characters, which I think is perhaps the only very comprehensive piece on those books or that character, but that is a good piece, and to my mind that's a good piece. Perhaps there will be more in-depth criticism later sometime.
What would you say about the influences on your writings by other writers?
Not consciously very great. I indicate that I was influenced to begin to write short stories by reading D.H. Lawrence, which was a kind of immediate influence, not a long-term one. I read one volume of D.H. Lawrence's short stories and decided I'd like to write some myself in Moscow. in my poetry, Carl Sandburg, I think, had some influence. He was a great admiration of mine in my youth, and his first books came out while I was still in high school, I believe, or, you know, around 1916. And so I read him. From Carl Sandburg, I went to Walt Whitman, but not for a number of years. And so I think the idea of writing free verse, unrhymed poetry really initiated with Sandburg. And I, probably like most American youngsters in my childhood, I probably had the idea that all poetry had to rhyme. And I learned from Carl Sandburg that that was not true. And perhaps subconsciously from the Bible, because I think I always appreciated the beauty and the rolling rhythms of the Bible from the time that I heard it as a child in Kansas. But other than those two sources, I don't... Paul Ernst Dunbar, yes, I should certainly credit him with, to some extent, influencing my attempts to get the folk element into my poetry and also to get humor into my poetry. So I would say Dunbar and Sandburg in the Bible.
Mm-hmm. What about any movements? And you don't consider yourself as being influenced by any movements like naturalism, realism?
No, I don't. No, I never quite knew what most of them were. I'm not really a literary... I don't analyze writing very much myself, and I've read not too much criticism, really, and I'm not sure. In fact, I know I don't know what existentialism is, actually, although I've read a lot about it. So I'm not consciously a member of any school or movement.
Mm-hmm. What do you think you will concentrate on in the future, if you will concentrate on anything in particular? What kind of writing? How about short stories? Do you think you'll write any more short stories?
Oh, I like the short story form very much. I hope that sometime I will write some more, but I don't plan really that clearly ahead, except by contract. And at the moment, I'm contracted to do a book on Harlem, and I'm contracted to do two more books for young people, for children. So those are my only plans. And whatever else I may do on my own, I haven't any idea at the moment.
Mm-hmm. These are books like the
Watts, first book, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What about the gospel song play? Do you think you'll explore that form any further?
I don't think I will explore the theater at all any further than I already have, because it's a very ungrateful field in which to work, and I have on my shelves now a half a dozen unproduced, unpublished plays. So unless something happens with one of those or more, I see no point in writing any more until what I have, or part of what I have, is utilized.
Do you think that a deep study of your best short stories and your best poems would cover most of your achievements, or would illuminate most of your purposes as a writer?
No. I mean, if an overall study were made of my work, I would very much like to see my autobiographical volumes included as well, not just the short stories or my poems, and of course my novels are. There are at least two novels. There's Tamarind to Glory, Not Without Laughter, and I call Simple Takes a Wife a novel.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say there's three novels. That, I mean, if anybody's going to really study my work at all, you can't study one part of it separately from the other and get an overall picture. Of course you can do the short stories as you yourself did and indicate the overall, but I would think that a real critique on my work would include everything,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't you?
That would be a book of some...
Well, not necessarily, but it wouldn't have to be too big, but it would have to be rather
to touch on the novels. as well as the short stories and the poems,
yeah,
and the autobiography.
I would think mm-hmm. so.
There are a few small points that I wanted to clear up.
Ah, yeah. Uh-huh.
Possible.
You want to turn it off while you think about it?
No, these I have, I think, at my fingertips here. In 1953, you received the Annisfield Wolfe's Award for what book?
Oh, it was for Simple Speaks His Mind, I believe, and it was only, it was divided between myself and someone else, mm-hmm. Which can be ascertained. I don't remember.
Yeah, I remember reading an article about it, but it didn't mention mm-hmm. it. I assume that it might have been Laughing People and Crying.
No, it was the first Simple book.
I see. Mm-hmm. Here's a factual bit of data I wondered about, and that is your mother's death. You have no reference, no reference to the date or
About 1937, I think. It was while my play, Don't You Want to Be Free, was running. 1935, 1936, 1937. That, of course, could be found, but I don't have it in my mind at the moment.
I remember you're discussing her in the Big C.
Uh-huh.
When you went to Oberlin.
Yeah.
You didn't find any trace of the date.
No, well, she had not died. Let's see, the Big C ends before her death.
1930.
The volume ends, the experiences detailed there end before she died.
And I wonder, as I wonder, it ends at 1937, I think, or the end of 36.
Yes, well, then she still was.
Yeah.
I still have another two or three autobiographical volumes to write.
That's why I did.
Yeah.
Do you remember whether or not the poem Theme for English B was printed before it was collected in the selection?
Yes, it was. It was printed, I'm sorry, now I can't remember, but it definitely was published mm-hmm. before.
I thought I had seen it somewhere.
It would be on the bibliographical list somewhere.